Welcome to another episode of Bite-Size Biographies, the podcast of life stories. My name is Corey Thorpe, and if you want to tell your life story on this podcast, go to bitesizebiographies.com/story now. Ash, thank you very much for coming and speaking with me and taking the time to share your story with everyone.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
So why don't we start at the beginning? Let's talk about what life was like for you as a young child.
Yeah, so I mean, I guess we can start before the beginning okay. A little bit. My parents were together for a few years before they had me, but my dad actually had terminal cancer.
Oh my gosh.
So, he was like diagnosed with stage 4 cancer and had like a really rough experimental treatment. And so they actually told him that he was infertile. So my parents really wanted kids, but they like got married anyway. They were like, oh, we'll just like figure something out, like see what happens. And, I was kind of like a miracle accident baby.
That's fantastic.
So yeah, it's really interesting. And I didn't find that out until I was much older that like, oh, I wasn't supposed to be born, but, it kind of puts a weird dynamic on, you know, the parent-child relationship. I feel like it's like, it's a lot of pressure.
Yeah, definitely.
But you know, it makes me grateful, I guess. But I grew up in Detroit. And so we were just kind of, my dad had kind of a Cinderella story where he worked his way from being like working at a Kmart store to like working in corporate and up and up and up.
Wow.
So when we grew up in Detroit, it was like pretty modest. And then, you know, gradually as we got older, like it was just like promotion after promotion and, you know, life started getting better. But, I really loved growing up in Detroit. It was a really diverse upbringing, I felt like.
Yeah.
Like there was a lot of different kinds of people that I was surrounded by all the time. And so that kind of like shaped how I see other people and shaped how I see the world. You know, it's just like there's a lot of different kinds of people around you who think a lot of different things, and that's totally okay.
Yeah.
You know, we all live together.
It sounds like a nice community.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't think that's necessarily like exactly what people would place on Detroit nowadays, like whenever it first comes to mind. But no, yeah. I thought it was great.
All I know about Detroit is that it's cold.
Right. It's extremely cold. You only stay inside for recess if it's like below 5 degrees. But yeah, I think it was kind of high stress growing up, though. Like there were a lot of expectations on us, even as kids.
Oh, really?
Yeah, we did have a lot of fun, but there were just a lot of pressures early on. And I didn't know how to articulate that or I guess how to process it as a little kid.
Pressures from your parents?
Yeah, just, you know, to be academically, like, I think our parents were really pushing. Mm-hmm. I think every parent does this, but you want to start to really early identify ways in which your kid is, like, gifted or excels in something or another. Like, I learned to read really early because my mom worked really hard at it with me and, like, played the little Hooked on Phonics card games with me.
Yep.
But
I remember those.
You know, I don't think it was necessarily because I'm, like, inherently a genius. It was just, you know, she put a lot of love and time into that.
Yeah.
But, yeah, there was just kind of always a lot of pressure in school and in things like sports, academics to, like, it felt like there was always a probe of, like, are you going to like take over the world with this gift or this sport or this, you know, something? And I think part of that pressure maybe just comes from, you know, my parents being type A people. Part of it maybe from the fact that I was some sort of like miracle birth, possibly just because my dad was experiencing so much success in the workplace.
Yeah, I was going to ask if you understood that as a kid. So you kind of understood, hey, he's being successful and it's going to be expected of me to do that as well.
Exactly. Yeah, there were pressures on me, I think. And then you'd notice things changing in your environment. Like all of a sudden the furniture is upgraded, you know, even though we're staying in the same house,
yeah.
We're eating out maybe once or twice a week and things like that. So that was a big difference from before.
Did you like the pressure or was it a little much?
It was a little much. I feel like it always had been.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was just like this pressure to be something successful, something world changing, something, I don't know.
Something.
Yeah.
What was it like just kind of in a normal like day for you? What was it like being a kid in Detroit? Did you have to bundle up all the time or when it was like summer? Was it hot and muggy?
We would bundle. There's like a procedure in Detroit. If you're going to go anywhere, even if it's just to like walk to your car and come back, you have your, you know, your jeans and your t-shirt. You put a sweater on over that. You do snow pants. Maybe a kind of jacket on top of that, and then your puffer coat, and then your boots.
Oh my gosh. Snow pants too.
It was kind of extreme. In the winter months, we would pretty much 24/7 be having snowball fights with our neighbors, like across behind the fence from us. We would kind of use the fence as almost like a
cover.
Yes. And we would like make forts and trenches and just, it was great. You would play ice hockey in the street and then just scream if a car came.
Yeah.
It was good. It was good times.
Did you play hockey? You mentioned sports before. Did you play hockey at school or did you play any other sports?
Not until I was a lot older. It was more just like I was thrown into a lot of different activities. Mm-hmm. So dance, music, piano, all of that sort of
thing. And you had to be the best at everything?
Yes, exactly.
So what took you out of Detroit? Where did you go after?
My dad actually worked for Kmart and we moved right before, you know, everything went under with that, you know, like the recession came, everything got really gnarly. So I was 11 at the time and my dad took a new position that was going to be another promotion for him. He was going to be on like executive level and it's like a really big deal. And so my little brother and I are just like, okay, sounds great. We're moving to Texas.
Oh, wow.
I personally thought that it was going to be just like Detroit, except for not as much snow and horses everywhere. So I was like, this is fantastic. This is like a dream come true for me. In reality, it was a huge culture shock because I was 11 years old. And at that time, you begin to kind of more cognizantly like process exactly what your values are or what you want from the world around you. And I came from this really diverse, you know, school, neighborhood, everything. And whenever I showed up in Texas, like, whoa, all of the houses look the same. We moved to kind of like a really wealthy suburb right outside of Dallas, like in between Dallas and Fort Worth. And so it was a huge culture shock because all of a sudden I'm in this really high affluence area. It was really difficult because, you know, suddenly I mean, I hate to phrase it this way, but it was all of a sudden being plopped in somewhere where like everyone was pretty much white. You know, there was just a lot of like perfectionism, a lot of value placed on material things.
Right.
But in a really extreme way.
Yeah, and so you went from a place where there were different opinions and different perspectives and everything wasn't the same. And then all of a sudden you went to a place where the houses looked the same. The people were kind of looking and acting similar. And it was just like, wow.
Yeah, it was a lot.
change of scenery.
Yes.
So what was Texas like?
My teenage years got really kind of rough. I got really angsty, I guess you could say. I was really frustrated because I just wanted to, I had a really hard time making friends. Yeah. And I just wanted to go up and shake these people and be like, you have no idea what real life is like.
Yeah.
You know, you have no idea like how much you need to care about the person next to you. Like it's a danger. You have no idea what's going on in the rest of the world.
Yeah. That must,
which as an 11 or 12 year old, like that's not really something that you can just like affect change with.
No, definitely not. It must have been really tough. How did you deal with it?
I got really heavy into band and music. I was a writer from a very young age and I've always throughout my life had really good teachers. I feel like I've, and I married a teacher. So I'm like,
well, there you go.
Psychologically seeing everything come full circle.
Yeah.
But, I spent a lot of time with teachers. I spent a lot of time writing. Mm-hmm. And then, I was really lucky to be in a good music program.
What kind of music? What instrument did you play?
Oh, I played clarinet.
Okay.
Yeah. Clarinet, saxophone, piano, mellophone, all sorts of stuff.
So you play a lot. You're very musical.
Yeah, I was. I don't practice so much anymore. But then it was kind of my coping mechanism. So
sure.
Yeah, whenever people talk about extracurriculars, maybe not as being as important, especially in funding, I'm like, oh no, it is something that kids hang on to for dear life to deal with their stress.
Right. Because some people might not have realized it, but for a lot of kids, they needed that.
Yeah.
So you had your band and you also had writing. What kind of writing did you do?
I wrote a lot of poetry and then I wrote short stories.
Okay.
I can remember always being really mad at myself that I could never draw out a short story into a novel because I was like, that pressure that I felt in childhood, it really amped up as a teenager. And so my days of, you know, going to school, coming home, doing band practice, doing, you know, my homework, things like that, mm-hmm. it was just became this routine of like, you don't sit down when you're in the house.
Right.
Like you're always
going,
just doing something. There was no permission to relax. And I got really mad at myself because I could never adapt one of these short stories into a full novel.
Was that the goal in your head?
Yes. Like if I could just publish a novel by the time I was like 16, 17, then all of my problems would be fixed. Like everyone would be proud of me. It wouldn't matter if I had friends or not. My grades wouldn't matter because I'm like, listen, I'm published. You don't need to worry about it.
Yeah. You'd at least get an A in English.
Yeah.
So did the pressure that you had described when you were a little younger, did that keep up all the way through teenage years and high school, you know, pressure to do the best and be the best?
The pressure was still pretty real. It started kind of manifesting itself in panic attacks.
Oh, no.
Whenever I was about 15, 16.
Yeah.
Which was really terrifying because at that age, it's not like today in social media and a lot of, you know, awareness about mental health.
Sure.
And these are the concrete things to look for and look out for.
So it wasn't as well known in the public eye what these were, and you were experiencing them and they were terrifying you.
Yes, exactly. And it kind of turned into this all day, every day anxiety spiral.
Oh, that sounds terrible. It sounds so difficult to deal with. And so without knowing what it is, you probably couldn't get medication or something to help you deal with it?
No. And my parents had started getting really heavily involved with church, which this is sort of a dangerous thing about some parts of religion and church going and whatnot. Like it can be really, really healthy. But then there are some ways in which it's like, you know, I really needed some mental health help. Just take the steps to be, you know, more passionate about what's in front of you with your faith and with church and with God, then these mental health problems wouldn't be plaguing you right now.
So you said you needed some help with your mental health and they were explaining to you that if you had more passion and faith, you wouldn't have those problems?
Exactly.
Oh my gosh. I can't even imagine how you could deal with that. Did you find a way to get the care that you needed or what ended up happening?
Not necessarily. What ended up happening is that it all kind of just spiraled out of control. Like my parents eventually conceded and got me counseling outside the church.
Okay.
And that helped for a little bit.
Yeah.
But I can remember they didn't like the counselor very much. And so they felt that she was being counterproductive. So we ended that. And eventually I had so many panic attacks that I sort of led to an almost suicide attempt and I was institutionalized.
Oh no, I am so sorry.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing because I think the misconception about institutions is that they are there to rehabilitate you.
Yeah.
And they're really not. I mean, unless you're at a really, really nice one, I guess, but for the most part, they're there to detain you. Like they're there to make sure that you do not kill yourself. That's their primary goal. And they will you know, try to ship you out with a diagnosis if they feel like you're not an immediate threat. But other than that, they're not really these places where it's like, ah, oh, I get a reprieve. Like,
right.
Finally, I can start to understand what's going on in my brain. Really, they're more like, it's kind of, it was almost like I felt like I was in juvie.
Yeah, it sounds like it's just a different kind of prison where rather than punishing you for being bad, they're punishing you for having a problem that you need help with.
Exactly. Yeah. And you get stuck with needles a lot. Yeah.
My gosh. How old were you around that time?
I was 17. I was 2 weeks away from being 18 years old.
Okay.
Which was scary for my parents because I was still right at the age where they were, CPS was threatening, like, hey, if you don't get her to the institution in time, like, we're going to get involved. Because I was technically still a juvenile.
Right. So they held you at this facility. What ended up happening? Did they just eventually, they deemed you weren't a threat to yourself and said, okay,
yes,
be on your way?
They said, you know, she's not suicidal directly anymore. Mm-hmm. And then it was mandated that I see a psychiatrist. Mm-hmm. And I was given a preliminary diagnosis of bipolar 1. Mm-hmm. Was my preliminary diagnosis. And then I was given a prescription for medication that I had to take. Mm-hmm. And then see this psychiatrist. So it felt okay. Whenever I heard the bipolar thing, I was like, finally, someone tells me what's wrong with me. you know?
Right. You have a thing now.
There's a word for it. There's a name to it. It's something I can Google.
Yeah.
It's like, finally, this is all I've been asking for is just some answers.
Right. Hopefully made you feel a little bit better.
Yeah. And what I was kind of met with was a lot of cynicism of, oh, you probably don't really have that. Mm-hmm. It's probably not that bad. Mm-hmm. You probably don't even need to take medication.
Right.
You know, and this was from family, church, friends, oh, you name it. So it was kind of like I was booted out with this diagnosis thinking that it was finally going to help me. Mm-hmm. And instead I was just met with all of this criticism that made me feel even more guilty.
Yeah, that's really unfortunate. It's like you're making progress and then your progress gets cut short by all the people around you.
Yeah.
Maybe not all of them, but enough of them that it is hurtful.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, where do you go from there? Did the medication actually help or was it not doing what it should?
Actually, the medication helped quite a bit.
Oh, that's good.
My relationship with my family didn't necessarily improve nominally. Mm-hmm. There was still a lot of mistrust and, mm-hmm. you know, I didn't feel emotionally safe in that environment. Mm-hmm. And I would feel guilty about that. Like, I'm supposed to be a good daughter. I'm supposed to, you know, make my parents proud, do the right thing. So I always had this back and forth of feeling guilty, but wanting to do what I knew was right for me. And just every answer was wrong all the time.
I think a lot of people can relate to that sentiment where you know what you want to try and do, and it seems like everything's standing in your way from getting it done.
Yeah, it was shortly after I got out of the institution that I had met some girls in there that were like, quote unquote, bad girls. Mm-hmm. And because, you know, they're the ones that are getting into trouble using substances. And that's kind of how you end up in an institution.
Yeah.
Most of my friends were from church because that's how after we moved to Texas throughout my adolescence, my parents got really heavily involved in church. And so that's where the majority of my friends were. Uh-huh. But I met these other girls, you know, in this mental health jail, mm-hmm. that basically, like, I kept connections with after I got out. And that's whenever I started drinking.
Yeah.
So that I first kind of like had an interest in it, you know, was curious about it. I was like, you know what? Everything's kind of gone to crap anyway. Like, mm-hmm. why don't I try being a little bit rebellious? Because everyone else in high school drinks. I'm 18 now. I'm about to graduate. Who cares?
Sure.
You know, I was like, maybe this might help. And pretty much from right out of the gate, really, from the first time I drank, mm-hmm. it was probably 2 months after my 18th birthday. I just hit the ground running with that. Mm-hmm. I was like, this is going to solve all my problems. I don't have to care about anything.
Yeah.
From very early, I was using alcohol as a way of like this is a way that I can passively almost be like committing suicide or passively damaging myself without necessarily dealing with the direct consequences to my friends and family.
Right.
Yet.
Right.
You know,
I know exactly what you mean. And so how did that go? I'm sure the first couple of times it might have seemed like it was going to work out well, but I sense a butt coming eventually.
Yeah. So it was strange because I didn't actually, in recovery, people talk about your consequences of your drinking mm-hmm. that led you to realizations. Well, I didn't really have consequences mm-hmm. my first year or so of drinking. I kind of just was able to slide by with everything. I would take wine in a tumbler, like coffee tumbler, to school with me. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I don't care about anything. I'm about to graduate. None of my teachers care, whatever.
Yeah.
And, you know, things like that where it's just so crazy to me looking back on it that I didn't have any consequences right out the gate. Yeah. Like, how would things have been different if maybe I was caught red-handed that early on?
Yeah.
But I ended up going to college and I got into a small Christian university mm-hmm. and I had some periods like right before I left college where I was like, no, I'm going to get back on track with my faith. Mm-hmm. You know, I met a nice boy. And so that always helps, like getting a church boy.
Sure.
You know, you're like, this solves all my problems. So clearly I can just scoot off to college. No problem. That did kind of calm my drinking down a little bit because I was like, I have a lot going for me right now. I have this boy. I just got into school. I'm going to really try to get involved in my church again. Like, I'm going to be good. I'm finally away from my parents. I'm out of my household. So this is my chance to design life on my terms and make it good in a way that I know it can be. So I did have a little bit of a period of sobriety that first kind of year that I tried drinking.
Yeah.
And then about 6 months after that, the boy broke up with me.
Oh, no.
So, of course, everything was entirely his fault, you know?
Yeah.
And because of that, everything was so everyone else's fault. The entire world was against me.
Yep.
I went and drank again. And I drank with a few classmates that I thought that I knew pretty well. But I guess I didn't. I had just kind of started like going out drinking, partying with friends a little bit.
Yeah.
So I went over to one of my classmates' house in one of my extracurriculars at this tiny school that I was at.
Mm-hmm.
And he made me a drink and it was roofied.
Oh my God.
Yeah. And so that happened and I woke up the next morning and it's like a hangover, but 50 times worse. Like I can kind of remember just like crawling to my car and I texted him later and I was like, what happened? Mm-hmm. And he said, we had sex because you wanted to. And I was like, oh no, that's a whole load of BS. I don't remember anything after literally 10 minutes of walking into your door. Like, that is insane.
It sounds terrifying.
Yeah. So I finally made it back to my dorm and I had never watched an episode of SVU before. Like, shame on me. But I was like, well, the only thing that's going to make me feel better right now is showering because your head's a mess. You can't talk barely. You can't really think. You can't really do anything. So I just sat in the shower for like 3 hours or so.
Yeah.
And I can remember talking to one of my friends about it and I was like, should I? Like, this is not okay, right? And she was like, well, it's kind of your fault. You don't want to get in trouble for drinking. It was a very, very conservative school. And I was like, yeah, you know what? You're probably right. I'll just get in trouble. And like, you don't want to like cause a scene about anything. I don't really know.
Mm-hmm.
But I did end up going to the campus PD and they were like, well, this is a really serious offense on your part. Like, we should be getting you in trouble just for admitting that you were drinking underage.
Oh, wow.
I was like, okay, so like, this is no help.
Yeah, that's not right. Blame the victim.
Yeah. And then the police in the town had like filed a report, but they basically told me, hey, it's this guy's word against yours. Like, he's a grad student. He's like doing great things in the community. Like, it's just really not going to be worth your time to do something like this. And so I was like, oh, great. Okay.
It sounds like everybody was trying to avoid doing extra work at the cost of you being able to actually have something happen as a result of this event that was perpetrated against you.
Right.
That's really sad. I'm so sorry that that no one could realize that, you know, this is wrong. And okay, you drank underage, that's bad, but not even in the same realm of what happened.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and it's tough because every time I've told my story several times in different platforms and in program and things like that, because it's just the whole Me Too movement is so raw. Like it's so visceral of like almost every woman that I know has been assaulted.
It's horrible.
I don't know if it's because I'm young and I live in the city or what, but it's almost tough to talk about because every time you go back through the narrative and tell your story, there's always this grappling fear of, well, you know, what if I don't remember it correctly? What if I wasn't really roofied and it was just a really strong drink? And it's like, well, that doesn't change the fact that, you know, it was a blackout or, you know, things like that, where it's you constantly question yourself on how your narrative. Oh, sorry. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you now. I missed you for a second. So you were saying that every time you go back through this, you question yourself. And then it sounds like you started drinking again to cope with this.
Yeah, it was sort of an ironic relationship with alcohol at that point, because alcohol was the thing that put me in danger
right
in the first place. But I really chose to brush that aside for the sake of self-medication, for the sake of the chance to not exist for a window of time.
Yeah.
That was so much more important than, you know, the fact that I was just, I don't know, actively destroying myself.
So how did that manifest? What happened at school? Did you continue?
I failed out of school.
Oh my gosh.
And I was so angry with myself because I just felt like I was supposed to get it together. You know, like I should have just bucked up and said, you know, I shouldn't have been drinking. I'll just deal with this emotionally, get my behind back into church and everything's, you know, just power through it like you're supposed to.
Yeah. Like you're supposed to, but no one can.
Right. And I didn't. I just coped with alcohol. And then I was like, well, I'm just a bad person. That kind of became my narrative, I guess, is I'm just a bad person. This is how I'm going to act. And this is how I'm going to be, because I am not capable of anything else right now. So I failed out of school. I still refused to move home for a little bit. So I was couch surfing in this college town. And then finally, it just got to be so desolate of a situation that my parents came and got me. They showed up, stole me away in the night. They showed up one night and were just like, we can't have you living like this. Like, just come home and we'll see about getting you into the university nearby and the state university, and maybe you can just have a chance to restart. And on one hand, I thought a chance to restart sounds great.
Yeah.
And on the other hand, moving back in with mom and dad did not sound great, because that was kind of the first sense of peace or sense of self that I'd ever really learned was whenever I moved out.
Mm-hmm.
Whenever I moved out and I wasn't drinking. That was the best I'd ever felt in my entire life.
Yeah.
Actually making decisions for myself and deciding what I thought was right and wrong and what was best for myself.
Becoming yourself, becoming a person.
Exactly.
So what happened when you got home?
So whenever I got home, it was just kind of more back and forth struggle of, should I be in church and jump into this lifestyle and doctrine and everything, but still trying to grapple with where I was at emotionally and basically completely ignoring the fact that I had just experienced trauma and not giving myself any sort of leeway for that.
Yeah.
So it was just kind of a few years of living at home, not dating the best guys, drinking whenever I could sneak it or whatever, mm-hmm. and just constantly trying to put on a face of I'm great. I'm doing the absolute best that I can, and it's amazing, and just floundering.
Yeah.
I think I failed out of that state school another 3 times.
Oh my gosh.
And I was just constantly mad at myself.
Yeah.
You know, I had these jobs in retail and sales for apparel that I would be so passionate about and so driven, but I would just flounder. Partially because of the drinking, and then partially because I couldn't function as a person.
Yeah.
Not being sick about who I am.
Yeah. When did you actually get to talk about what happened?
That's actually a really good question. I honestly didn't talk about it, or I didn't really say anything about it to anyone until just maybe a few years ago. I moved out of my parents' house and into a nearby, like, really big city. And my drinking progressed to be really, really just bad. We're talking maybe 10, 15 drinks per day, every day, you know, wake up shaking, like not eating, that sort of drinking.
Oh, wow. How did you manage to move out of your parents' house? Did you save up and say, okay, this is it, I'm leaving, I want to, you know, I want to go find myself again? Or what?
Well,
what enabled you to be able to leave?
Yeah, like a typical alcoholic, I took out a payday loan.
Okay.
To be able to get a deposit on a place that was $400 a month in rent.
Uh-huh.
And I didn't have a car anymore. I had gotten a DWI. And so I would just walk everywhere in the city. And that was life. I would wait tables in the morning and, yeah, just drink every single night. It wasn't really until I moved out here that I started being more vocal of, hey, you know, this happened to me. I'm still not that big on, you know, blasting the story everywhere, because it's most women I know's story, I suppose. Like, honestly, whenever the Me Too movement kind of swept through it, like, I didn't say anything or do anything, because I'm like, it's just too much.
Yeah.
You're like, yeah, that's everybody.
So you were living on your own, dealing with what had happened to you without able to talk to anyone about it, drinking a lot, mm-hmm. you know, working and just paying your bills and drinking. And how long did that continue, or what changed? How did that cycle break?
So there was so much wrong. I owed my roommate $2,000 and ended up being evicted.
Oh, wow.
Then I had violated my probation, so I was kind of running from the law. And finally, I started suffering really bad health complications. If the finances and the legal stuff weren't bad enough, I wasn't eating anymore, really.
Oh, no.
I was maybe eating like once every 2 days, and my face and hands started going numb.
Oh my gosh.
Which was scary, but I think the final straw was I had kind of started seeing someone who's now my husband, and I can remember him just being so hurt that I would cognizantly choose to hurt myself. I could physically see that hurting and paining him. And I had this moment of clarity where I realized I got into this. I chose alcohol. Like, this was what was going to save me, and this is what was going to make me feel better, because I was just destroying myself. I could just slowly sink into the abyss,
right,
on my own and not have to hurt people around me. And I finally woke up and saw a very clear way in which I was hurting someone around me. And then, you know, it made me process finally about what I had actually done to my roommate and putting her in that financial situation. And basically the next day I just said, I can't do this anymore. And I'm done. I'm not going to drink anymore.
Wow.
Yeah. I ended up being able to take care of my legal situation, going back to court again. I thought I was going to go to jail and then I didn't. So that was really nice. But I ended up being able to over time pay back the finances.
Good.
So that was amazing. And sobriety is really weird. You know, the first few days and few months are you just wake up to get through the day, just exist through it, right? Just as long as you get your head on the pillow sober, you're good. You've done it that day. The bar is so low. Like, you can just be so proud of yourself just for the fact that you woke up and the fact that you went to bed without a drink. Like, that in and of itself is incredible.
Yeah.
So having that bar set back so low for me and being able to slowly build myself back up and slowly build up the expectations again was honestly one of the most beautiful things I've ever been through in my life. And I really didn't want to get into a recovery program at first. I was very against it because I was hurt by church. And so I equated all of that stuff with church because I had been, I was like, oh, well, this is an institution. It's a way to trick people into accepting a God idea. And I didn't want that. I said, I'm fine. I've had a God idea before and look where that got me. And so eventually, 6 months in, I had to go to like a court ordered rehab. Even though I was already sober, they wanted me to do it to show that I was serious about just getting back on probation and completing my charges.
Right.
And so I went to this rehab and I remember getting so mad at this old man because he kept saying, you know, if you don't get into program, you're going to relapse. You're going to have a relapse. And I kept telling him, I am just fine on my own. I don't need anything. I'm just fine. My relationship is fine. I have a place to live now. I have a job. I'm okay. And he just kept saying, you don't get it. Like, your mind's not going to heal itself. Your mind's not going to change if you don't surround yourself with other people.
Mm-hmm.
And he kept telling me that over and over again. And I got really angry at him. But finally, I just did it because I told him, I said, I'm so desperate to stay sober. I would chop my arm off. I would chop my own arm off to stay sober. And he was like, well, then the least you can do is try to go to a meeting. And so I did. And what I found was all of my original presuppositions about it were completely false. So there wasn't this whole pushy, we're going to shove God down your throat sort of mentality. It was just people that were real and raw and happy and really knew how to take account of their own behaviors and solve their own problems, which I thought was crazy. Like, they would just talk about in meetings, especially the other women that I watched. I can never be grateful enough for the women in sobriety that helped pull me up. I would just listen to them saying, you know, I had this and this problem today, and I did A, B, and C, and this was the outcome. And I just kept hearing these stories of how to, I don't know, just manage your life. And I had never experienced, I had never had tools before. I had never had support like that before.
Yeah, it sounds very conscious of your existence.
Yes, exactly. And very conscious of your gratitude, really. You start being really grateful for very, very little things whenever you're building up from nothing.
So you built yourself up, you started getting everything back on track and getting everything right with the law, and you found these programs. And after you satisfied the requirements they had for you to go to the program, did you continue going?
I did. And I'm still in it today.
That's good.
What kept me in was that I had a really good sponsor. And she was so adamant about me serving other people and teaching me what that actually means and how to actually do it, not just in program, but outside of program too. And so what really kept me in, I think, was seeing the people that came after me. Whenever, you know, whenever I came, there was women that just surrounded me and pulled me up and encouraged me and my sponsor. And then you get 6 months, a year in, and it's like, oh no, I have a job to do. I need to be here for the person that's walking in the door after me. So that's kind of why I stayed.
And that makes sense. So you could give back to the community that gave you so much.
Exactly.
So what was going on in the other areas of your life at that time? You obviously were still with who would become your husband.
Yeah, we got married 2 years after I got sober. What happened was I learned a lot about how to enjoy work and how to be a good worker. That was something that I had never been taught. Work was just an extension of my perfectionism before, really, is all that was. Mm-hmm. Eventually, we got our own little house together, which I was really proud of. I was working two jobs, got all my legal stuff together, got a little car, got my little driver's license back. So that was all really good. And then, life started really getting better. There's a lot more to it, obviously, as far as the grunt work and the blood, sweat, and tears, lots of tears, that go into taking it day by day whenever you're trying to restructure your entire life.
Sure.
But it was inherently a very good thing. And then one night, my now husband and I were in the middle of moving, and it was chaos. There were boxes everywhere. I was stressed out, and I said something snotty along the lines of, I wish we could just be married already, or something like that. And he was like, oh, yeah, well, I'll show you. And he goes to the other room, and he apparently had a ring for weeks, and he proposed to me. So, yeah, we ended up getting married.
That's fantastic. So you guys got married, and it sounds like you had a little house that you got together. You were working two jobs. Did you go back to school? Did you give school another try, or did you find that it wasn't for you?
I did give school another try. So I had actually, long before I got sober, I had been really interested in, and honestly, YouTube binging, a lot of funeral directors.
Okay.
So I had done extensive research about the career field and the educational requirements and really what it would entail. And I just had this burning desire because I felt as though it was a way that I could help people, but it's a way that a lot of people don't want to touch.
Yeah.
For obvious reasons, I understand, but I feel like I would be just as happy if I were a teacher or a social worker or working towards something like that. I would be just as happy of a person. It's just the fact that I felt the need to go into this career because I think a lot of the finding out what you want to do when you grow up just revolves around just find a verb. Find a verb that suits you. Like if you like to speak, perfect. That's something to take and run with. If you can write, if you can. For me, I was like, I have to be helping people. In whichever form or fashion I can do that, if I'm a nurse, if I'm a teacher, if I'm an anything, I will be able to rest my head easy at night as long as that's the verb that my day entails. But I felt like I was capable of doing it in death care, and maybe not a lot of people wanted to do that. And so that's why I felt compelled to go ahead and study it. So I told myself, okay, I want to work in the industry for at least a year before I go ahead and enroll in school, because I really want to make sure that I got the chops for it. I'm cut out for it.
It makes sense.
Yeah, that's the advice that's kind of normally passed on in the industry is if you think you might be a fit for it, try working. Try hands-on work before you try school. So I did that, and I ended up getting a job as an admin at a really big funeral home, and I worked my behind off. It was before I got a car. I would wake up at 4:45 in the morning so I could get on the bus.
Oh my gosh.
Yes. I became obsessed with it though. Even though I was just doing the admin work, if I was like typing up an obituary, I was like, it just meant the world to me that I could be the one to type up an obituary to email to the newspaper for this one family. That just meant the absolute world to me. And then I was finally able to, I learned so much. I was finally able to get into school though. And that had just been an incredible experience every step of the way. Because my professors are very much encouraging free thought, critical thinking, things like that, which are kind of hard pressed to find in my industry. It's a very rigid industry. There's traditions and there's ways of doing things and there's ways of not doing things. And there isn't really a whole lot of budge room for experimental concepts in there. But at my school, I mean, we're really pushed to delve deeper and question every single thing we do as a funeral director. And so it really has shaped my perspective into, I think a lot of people see a funeral director as kind of a surly businessman in a suit, probably a really nice one, going to be really serious, maybe a little bit creepy. And in reality, I saw an opportunity to say, okay, what is the art of funeral directing to me? And I just see myself as a caretaker every single day. Sometimes it's really hard to be wearing a suit with all the ups and downs and moving we do. But so that's a whole other thing. But I definitely see myself as a caretaker. I'm in people's homes every day. You know, I'm holding you. I'm holding people. I get hugs every day. I come home from work and my blazer is covered in, not in tears that are not my own, you know, things like that, that I just think are really important to touch and feel every day. And okay, I have to address this because everyone asks me, isn't it so creepy being around dead bodies? And it's not at all.
Uh-huh.
Listen, we're all going to smell like the really fancy cheese aisle of the expensive grocery store whenever we pass away. Like, that's just human. But in all honesty, it's not. My best friend, who's a nurse, has a way more disgusting job than I do. It's really not disgusting at all. It's, you literally just, you know, you pick these people up, you move them, you take care of them. And it's just like, you look at them and you're like, this is a person, this is a human being. It's, you know, seen as quasi property or whatnot. But it's, to me, whenever I'm working with someone or I'm putting makeup on them or I'm picking them up or I'm moving them, I see it as this is still a person. So even if their spirit's not in there, this shell still represents every experience their loved ones have ever had with them. So this shell is still really, really important.
I think you have a beautiful perspective on your job that probably a lot of people don't really know much about. It sounds like you help not only the person who is now not with us anymore, but also all of the people that meant something to that person.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And everyone always asks me, oh, that job must be so depressing. How do you cope with that? Truthfully, it's not depressing hardly at all. Unless in the case of, you know, young people, like really, really young, or kids, that always will.
Yeah.
That will never be okay. But honestly, it gives me perspective because I go into work every day and I'm reminded that I'm going to die one day, right? So a little bit egocentric, but still I get this perspective shift. I get a realignment every day that I go into work that it's really difficult for me to come home at the end of the day and be upset about trivial things that don't matter in life, in my marriage, with my extended family, with my friends, or even with my coworkers at work. Like, it's just a lot harder to get anxious or upset about small things because you're working with death every day of how fragile everything is. So it kind of has helped. I do think working in my industry has helped heal my mental health, because it's done a lot to calm my anxieties.
So does that bring us close to today, or does that bring us up to today in your story?
That brings us to today.
Fantastic. Well, I would ask you if there's anything that you're passionate about. However, I think we can all, you know, it's very obvious that you're extremely passionate about your job. I don't know if there are other things that you wanted to kind of plug or...
One thing that's becoming really, really important to me is doing things that you want to do, even though you might feel like you're really bad at them. For example, like I really enjoy like painting and knitting. I'm not good at either of those things. Like, I basically just knit things that are really long squares, but in rectangles. Like, that's the only thing I can knit. But just doing things that I enjoy for the sake of doing them and not having to be perfect at anything, that's been my jam lately.
Well, Ash, I think we've come to the end of your story so far. I want to say thank you once again. Really, thank you for sharing your story and for your time.
Oh, absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
That's it for this week's episode. If you enjoy this show, please rate it highly wherever you listen to podcasts. Or if you have ideas about how we can improve the show, go to bitesizebiographies.com/feedback and let us know. Thank you for listening.